we were clued in as to where he was going. It was off air that was harder to see where it was heading. Chapter 33, Building Sting, 1990. Almost from the start, the eventual goal was for Flair to pass the torch to Sting, and Sting be the babyface champion. Then the WCW creative would be in the process of building viable heels to chase the champion babyface, again playing off what WWF had done with Hulk Hogan, Watts with JYD, and Eddie Graham with Dusty Rhodes. It was a simple philosophy. Some territories are heel territories, where you've got a heel champion and the babyface's chase. And some are the opposite. I wanted Sting to be our flag bearer and for more heels to be created to chase him. But for that to happen, we first needed Flair to pass the torch. Then, during the main event of Clash of Champions Texas Shootout, Sting blew out his patella tendon trying to get into the steel cage. In the very same match where Flair had turned on him to start their feud. So, of our top two heroes, one had turned villain, and the other got injured. It was a disaster. So we needed to turn Lex Luger back, even though he had been heating up as an arrogant villain. Luger wasn't cast in any one role long enough for people to get in a groove about him, how they really felt about him. Pro wrestling wasn't Lex's natural calling because he didn't have an innate aptitude for it, so adapting to those multiple changes didn't come organically for him. With help and time, Lex improved on his promos, and while never being great, he was always good enough to get by because of how he looked. Having watched him closely for months, I thought he could have learned more, absorbed more, when he was with the Horsemen. There wasn't a better place in the wrestling world to be if you wanted to learn how to make money. Lex was with a perfect entity to just be quiet, to watch and learn. I had dealt with guys I enjoyed working with more. Luger was never rude to me, but I found him to be somewhat aloof and arrogant at times. He placed a very high value on his look, which is fine, as I understood that in the wrestling world, you have to do that to maintain your sanity sometimes. But he wasn't as advanced as he thought he was. He never met a mirror that he didn't embrace, and really, that was his big priority, the look. Lex thought the look was going to get him farther down the road than it actually did. It certainly got him noticed, and he always looked the part without question. But his in-ring skill set was not advanced to push him up to that next level. So with Sting out, Lex was put in the Capital Combat pay-per-view with Flair, while Sting appeared with an unusual guest in RoboCop. "Fucking RoboCop?" I asked backstage. Keith Mitchell just nodded. "From the movie?" Keith nodded again. We had no choice. Turner's Home Entertainment Division cut a deal with the studio. "What are they expecting us to do with RoboCop?" I asked. Keith replied, "We have to figure it out." Well, there wasn't much to figure out. RoboCop was essentially useless. Not just as a character, but as a prop, too. He couldn't do a run-in because he couldn't move faster than a snail in his costume. He couldn't walk up steps, so we couldn't get him in the ring. And he couldn't throw a punch or take any moves because the suit was so restrictive. So we had to come up with a wrestling angle for a guy in a full body cast. The executives wanted us to be seen as Hollywood friendly, just like Vince was in WWF. During the introduction of Sting in RoboCop, our hero Sting was pushed into a cage by three of the dastardly Four Horsemen, where he had to wait for RoboCop to shuffle down the aisle and rip off the cage door to free him. "They gave us a plate full of horse shit, and we have to make it kind of edible," Ole said. RoboCop aside, Sting was ready to be champion. He wanted it. The fans wanted it. but others didn't. Ric Flair had a lot of allies. He was the best performer in the world, one of the top three I'd ever seen. He was already a made man, a legendary figure. So with a title or not, he was going to be a huge part of the shows and a huge draw for the fans. Problem was, Flair saw himself as the champ. He didn't like the idea of not being associated with the big gold belt. It wasn't the first time that Rick had put the brakes on a potential new champion. A few months earlier, I had mentioned Japanese star, the Great Muda, as a possible future champion too. Rick was having none of it. Jim Herd curiously heard about my suggestion afterward, even though he wasn't even there, and simply said, "There's no way we can get people to cheer a Japanese guy." A few months later, at the Great American Bash, Sting did get his victory over Flair. It was a huge moment that was, again, dick-punched by events outside the Stinger's control. Bad booking, overly complex finishes, and no red-hot heel waiting to chase the new champion hurt Sting's ability to cement his place at the top of the card. As fellow booking committee member Kevin Sullivan said, "You never saw a knight become a knight by slaying a salamander. He's got to kill a big dragon to be a hero." But Ole had a master plan to bring Sting his dragon to slay, and that dragon's name was the Black Scorpion. Actually, he didn't have a master plan. He had a half a plan. And even that half a plan was just a screw you to everyone. When the management said they wanted a big angle for their TV and pay-per-views, Ole decided to give them just that. He started an idea with no plan on how to finish it. "I can book what I want," he said. "But what's the plan?" I asked. "We'll figure it out when we get there." At that point, Ole wasn't getting along with anyone and kind of isolated himself from outside points of view. In trying to block out the bad advice of the upper management, he simply blocked out all advice. Black Scorpion was going ahead, whether there was an end for it or not, and Ric Flair was coming with him. Flair, of course, hated the idea. The Black Scorpion was some masked, mysterious man from Sting's past, who sounded like Ole, because Ole did his voiceover on television. He was also a different height and weight every time he was seen because he was being played under the mask by different wrestlers. Flair hated it so much, he refused to have anything to do with it right up until the last messy seconds. Ole was an old-school, do-what-I-say booker. And at the back of it all, Flair was an old-school team player. The Nature Boy, like any other performer or athlete, was anxious about doing something so out of his comfort zone that a little guidance or coaching might have made all the difference. When the Nature Boy finally pulled off the mask to reveal himself as the Black Scorpion, Rick made the very best of a bad situation, but also talked about quitting again. Chapter 34, Lady on a Plane, 1990. "You know I introduced you to her, Jimbo," Flair said. "We're about to board another plane to hit another town." Of course, I knew just who her was. Nothing lit up Flair's memory of Jan quite like a U.S. Airways flight. "How long did she last?" he asked as he sat down in his first-class seat. "We're moving in together," I said, as I sat down beside him. He was shocked. "What? Is she crazy?" "She must be." I thought the same. A few years before, Rick and I boarded a U.S. Airways flight from West Virginia to Atlanta. It was only a small flight with four first-class seats. Nature Boy and I were the only passengers that sat in two of the four available. "I'm really sorry," said the first-class attendant. "They told us there weren't any first-class passengers on this flight, so there's no breakfast to serve." "Is there vodka and orange juice?" Flair asked. "Yes," she replied. "Then there's breakfast, sweetheart," Flair said, and bring a Bailey's and coffee for my friend. I smiled at her with my $10,000 TV smile, and she smiled back. Rick immediately leaned into her line of sight. Can you also hang up my $20,000 robe? 'Cause I'm the world's heavyweight champion. Jan took the robe and disappeared to make the drinks. For the next 30 minutes, the Nature Boy wheeled out his best lines to try to catch her attention. You want me to put the robe on for you, honey? Flair asked. Luckily, she refused, as I knew that put the robe on meant just the robe. I had already seen Flair's private parts way too many times. Thankfully, she stuck to her job, keeping the drinks coming and generally faded into the background. But I couldn't help but notice how beautiful she was and what a great sense of humor she had as she told us some great jokes. When we landed, I readied my business card. Is that for her? Rick asked. Yeah, I replied. He burst into laughter. You really think she's going to go for you when she's been showing no interest in me? I put my card back in my pocket. Maybe Rick was right. Thank you guys so much for flying with us today. Hope you have a great day, Jan said as she handed Rick back his robe. Nate gathered his things and walked toward the door. I mumbled as I searched for my card again. I couldn't find my card. She had her own business card waiting for me. Is it okay to call you sometime, I asked. My number is there, she replied. It was because of that meeting on that flight that Ric Flair claimed he set Jan and me up on a date. And now you're moving in with the flight attendant that gave you her card, Jimbo, Flair asked. Yep, I replied. Rick could sense I was a little wary. He ordered some drinks, not to celebrate, just because he wanted to drink. You ready to be tied down again? He asked as he held up his glass to toast. I clinked my drink off his, not knowing how to answer. I knew I loved Jan and I didn't want to lose her. I also knew what a horrible husband I had been in the past. I'm not sure, I replied. I knew my dilemma didn't really affect Rick. To the Nature Boy, his wives were married, but at times he wasn't. Chapter 35, Haman, 1990. Paul Haman was an ambitious, aggressive, in-your-face, never-back-down pain in the ass, and I liked him immensely for it. I knew he was money because he was a born heel with the guys in the business hating him nearly as much as the audience watching the show. He didn't genuflect for no one and always called bullshit on the segments, people, or interviews he thought were bullshit. He hadn't been long fired from WCW, filed a lawsuit, and even met Vince about going to WWF. But I wanted him back. Unfortunately, I was surrounded by people who despised the New York Jew, quote-unquote, so much that they simply didn't want him around, no matter his value to the company. What if we bring him back and beat the shit out of him on the air? Jim Barnett asked. That would shut his mouth. Heyman once described Barnett to me as a flamboyant, evil son of a bitch. A cross between Truman Capote and Darth Vader. So that might have had something to do with Barnett's plan. I'll take him, I said. He can come with me, and I'll be responsible for him. The small cabal who were trying to figure out Haman's next step all shrugged their shoulders. As long as they didn't have to deal with him, they were fine with my suggestion. Just keep him away from us, was the general consensus. I called Haman and said, I know you haven't signed a deal with Vince, and I want you back here. About 6 months before, Flair sent Haman home for being a pain in the ass. But WCW would not release Paul from the remainder of his contract. This left Haman in quite the spot, as he couldn't come back to WCW because Flair wouldn't have it, and he couldn't go to WWF because he was still under contract. Paul felt he had no other recourse but to sue Turner and WCW. Jim, Paul said to me over the phone, I'm not going back there. They haven't paid me in 6 months, and Ric Flair will make my life hell. I can't get you back as an announcer, I said. They hate you too much to put you out front and center just yet. But I can get you back as a manager. I'm not interested. But if I was, who would I be managing? Mark Calloway. Oh, he's money. He sure is, I said. Mean Mark had already debuted with Teddy Long. Both men had zero chemistry, and Ole was looking at the big red-headed Texan as a write-off. I could sense that Paul was tempted. What if I worked out something that got you paid your 6 months that they owe you? What about Flair, he asked. If you don't pick a fight, I got your back. I could hear some shuffling down the phone line. What do you say, I asked. You come back now, do your 6 months of your contract, and then if you want to leave WCW, you'll be doing it with a clean slate. So when WWF is done with you, you can come back here. Okay, said. You're in? I asked. I'll see you tomorrow. Paul, before you hang up. Yeah? How's your driving license? It's clean. Good. Why? No reason. Pick me up at my house tomorrow. From there, he drove me everywhere, and during those rides, I passed on to him what had been passed on to me. All the lessons I learned from Watts, Ack, Hodge, all the stories, all the psychology, every chance I got, I'd bring Heyman on commentary with me as a guest. Our chemistry was undeniable. We would say the worst things to and about each other, but we always kept our eye on why we were doing that. We wanted to pull the audience in and then use our platform to enhance the action in the ring. With Paul at my side, I began to show him the ropes. I showed him how to fill out TV sheets and explained the rundown of a show. I thought it was a simple, run-of-the-mill gesture, but Paul didn't think so. When I looked up from the sheet, I could see Heyman was a little emotional. Thank you for showing me this stuff, he said. I tried to bat his sincerity away with a joke, but he was deadly serious. There was something in him that really appreciated me taking a risk on him and showing him how a TV show was put together. As the months went on, I fought for Heyman to come with me on the Saturday night show too. Everyone else railed against it, but I was adamant that he and I had something WCW could desperately use. We had believability. Get a suit, I told him, and dye your hair. Anything else, he asked. Show up ready to fight for your life because they're all rooting for you to fail. Good, he said. Fuck them. The next day, Paul collected me in his car, and we started our drive to the office. As we pulled out onto the road, I could see Heyman looking at my car, dusty, in the driveway. Paul, I said, how much do you learn from me in our preparation? I get the rhythm and the psychology, he said, so a lot. And how much do you learn in the car? I get 10% in the building, 15% around the locker room, and 75% from you in the car. Exactly. That's why you drive me around so much. I could see Heyman smiling. He wasn't buying it. What? I asked. Oh, you're doing me the favor by having me drive you everywhere. Exactly. That and the fact that my license is suspended. Heyman slapped the steering wheel with excitement. I knew it! I knew something was wrong. Even though he and I were in his car alone, I still looked behind me to see if anyone could hear what I was about to say. I got caught on a second DUI. They suspended my license for 90 days. I won't say anything. I felt like shit for even putting myself in such a lousy position. I should have never driven while drunk. I knew it, and I learned my lesson. As well as taking my license, they also made me pick up litter on the side of the road for 6 weeks. Even though I'd wear a semi-disguise of a baseball cap and sunglasses, sometimes people would honk when they saw the chubby-headed man from TV filling the plastic bag with soda cans. I'd happily drive you around for as long as you need it, he said. I believed him, too. And then he was gone again. Another fight with higher-ups, which resulted in Haman going home for another stint. I still have my eye on him, though. I knew I could help direct his energy and passion in the right direction. I just had to wait until this round of heat had left Haman's name. As soon as I saw an opening, I was going to pitch to bring him back in again. I couldn't let someone special like that just float off into the competition. Chapter 36, Changes, Old and New, 1990. Near the end of the year, Dusty Rhodes returned to replace Ole as booker. I heard that Ole quit, then heard he was fired, then that he quit. But no, he was fired. Either way, the wrestling world had changed around Ole, and he didn't seem to have the tools to deal with it. WCW wrestlers had guaranteed contracts, which meant they got paid no matter if they were injured, quote-unquote, or working hard, or taking his direction. This created a standoff, one which Ole could not win. His style of booking wasn't as painful to me as it was to other guys. I was used to that kind of person all the way along my wrestling journey. It was like my brain had evolved in a way of dealing with confrontational, abrasive, combative alpha male types. I knew as long as I did my job well, I would get paid either way. And that's all that mattered. I had enjoyed working with Dusty in the past because he was funny and he was low maintenance. He knew what he wanted. He wrote the show. He was doing the booking. The sense around the company was that people were happy to hear Dream was coming back. Dusty was a hit maker in the sense that he had crafted many, many memorable and money-making angles and characters with Crockett, and in Florida before that, with Professor Eddie Graham. We were all hoping he would come back and again catch that lightning in a bottle. In addition to him being Booker, Dusty was also going to join me on commentary, too. It was no surprise to me when he fit right in. He was charming, quick, knowledgeable, of course, and most of all, entertaining. He wanted to do well because that's just that wrestler ego. He wanted to do better than all the top names in both WCW and WWF. Dusty wanted to be better than Jesse Ventura, Jim Cornette, Bobby Heenan, or Paul Heyman. And he had all the tools to do it. I sat back when he was on a verbal run and listened to him make up words. He'd say things like, he was ugly. He wasn't ugly. He was ugly. That's worse than ugly. Then you add in his energy, delivery, slight lisp, and Dusty was a unique package on color. We had fun, and he had no issues if a match was real slow or whatever to kind of subtly jab the talent in the ring about it. Because what are they going to do? He's the booker. Dusty probably was about as stress-free to work with as anybody that I ever worked with. He didn't want a pregame. He didn't want a production meeting, as far as me and the announcers were concerned. He'd already thought the show through, gone over it in the truck with the director, gone over it with the talent and the agents. By the time it came down to him and me, he was tired of going over it, which suited me just fine. I knew enough to not get caught out with anything. Everything else we called on the fly. If I made a left and I should have made a right, he'd get us right back to where we were going. And I would hear it and I would adapt. In between matches, we'd make each other laugh and elbow each other. And he'd remind me of the time he beat me at horse over and over again. I'm still not stupid enough to beat the booker, I said. You're still smart then, he replied. Of all the matches and all the talent we saw, both Dusty and I agreed that there was one kid who had something special. He reminded us of a linebacker in the way he looked. Big, rugged, blonde hair. You could tell he was an athlete. He walked like an athlete. He carried himself like an athlete. He was intense from the get-go. I couldn't tell you if he was just nerves or because he was new and had gotten a big break from starving in Tennessee, or whether he was always that intense. He'd come up from Dallas, or Peyton Place, as it was called, because there was always some drama, some soap opera down there. That territory was unraveling with all the issues that were going on with personal lives and the lack of institutional control in the booking office and things of that nature. Steve Austin probably was happy to get away from some of that insanity. Little did he know that WCW bathed in its own brand of craziness. He was motivated, excited to compete. You could tell from the beginning that his mindset was, I'm going to be somebody. WCW was a fresh start for Austin, but he never struck me as a guy who was just happy to be there. Steve always had his game face on, and I think that came from a lot of the fact that he was an overachieving football player who was a big star in high school. He played linebacker at Wharton Junior College in Texas and then got a scholarship to North Texas State in Denton, Texas. Then he got the wrestling bug after watching world-class championship wrestling. He saw commercials for the Chris Adams Wrestling School, and he took a job on a freight dock to earn the money to attend. That not only got him trained, but booked, too. Steve told me he lived way outside of Atlanta, kind of away from everybody. He was a loner. I could see that he had made friends with Brian Pillman, which I thought was kind of the odd couple. Pillman was loud and extroverted, and Steve seemed to be a bit more reserved, a Cool Hand Luke kind of persona. As time moved on, I thought they made a very good team, on and off screen. The Dangerous Alliance was a big break for Steve because he was very non-political. He needed something to give him an identity and to give him a little bit of political foundation, and having the rehired Paul Heyman as his spokesman meant he was always going to get great ideas because Paul was always thinking. He had a group of guys there that were good independent thinkers as well. Rick Rude, Larry Zbyszko, and Arn Anderson, who have been big stars in their own rights, and you add Steve to that group, the youngest of the crew, who was kind of really the guy that was going to get the big rub at the end of all that. Then you had Medusa adding sex appeal and the female component to the mix, and with a great young manager in Heyman. It was a very good booking by Dusty. You had Larry, who WCW had nothing for. You had Austin, who they had nothing for really to speak of, in lieu of some of the basic stuff with Pillman for a while. And Dusty had confidence and knew about how good Arn was. Dream knew Heyman was a heat-seeking missile as a manager. And there weren't a lot of women, so adding Medusa to the group was a great move, as she was a brilliant heel. If they had stayed together over a longer period of time, they probably would have gone and been considered one of the more prolific factions ever. And Austin was a keeper. He just had something. Something that was worth keeping your eye on. It seemed Dallas was a rich vein for new talent around that time, but WCW didn't have a great track record in bringing that talent along and getting the most for their money. WCW was good at hiring guys with potential, then doing nothing with them. Mark Calloway was a great example of this. He was wrestling in Dallas as the Masked Punisher, but I knew no one in that promotion was making a lot of money. I saw money in him right away. You don't find too many 6'9" guys that could move around as athletically as he could. With us, he was making about $150,000 a year downside, and his contract came up for renewal. Ole was booking at the time, and I said, we need to address Calloway's contract. Well, he's never going to draw a dime, Ole said. Well, if that's your opinion, you're going to miss the boat on this guy, I replied. I don't want to hear another fucking word about it. I talked to Mark, and the word on the street was that McMahon was romancing him. I couldn't understand Ole's thinking, and it was the only time I ever pushed him so far that I thought he was going to punch me. As I saw it, you can't coach big. He was a legitimate athlete. Mark was 6'9", 300 pounds, the kind of guy that walks through the airport and everybody looks at. So he's what bookers generally clamor for. He was a head-turner, and Mark was a great guy, very down-to-earth and very unpretentious. He was kind of laid back, actually. Ole thought that Mark was just another big guy that hadn't found himself and therefore wasn't going to draw any money. You think they're going to give me anything here, Jim? Mark asked. Well, if the booker has no faith in you, why would you want to stay? I said. I don't need to know your business, and I don't want to know your business. But if you have the opportunity to go someplace else, based on what I know, I would explore it seriously. Soon after, I saw Mark on WWF TV working as the Undertaker. Dallas TV also brought a young Mick Foley to my attention. I was in equal parts fascinated by him and worried for him. He did the running elbow off the ring apron to the floor that was one of the coolest and riskiest moves I had ever seen. In the context of the show, it looked devastating for Mick's opponents. In the context of it being a human body facilitating the move, it looked devastating for Mick Foley. As a part of my job, I used to watch wrestling shows from the other territories in marathon sessions. Hours and hours of TV, countless moves, wrestlers, promos, and personalities, and Mick Foley stood out. And it wasn't just his risky moves or daredevil dives. It was his persona under the character Mick Foley as Cactus Jack worked equally well bell to bell or on the microphone. He was compelling with the volume turned up or down. I knew I wanted Mick to come to WCW. Chapter 37, Japan, 1991. Jan and I were kind of moved in together. I was still an asshole, afraid to commit, so she moved out again. I missed her more than anything, and I knew I was in danger of losing who I was and what I wanted. She was eager to move our relationship forward, but as someone in the twice-married, twice-failed club, I was in no rush to pull that lever again. As usual, just as she was packing her bags, I was packing mine too. It was for my first trip to Japan for WCW's co-promotion with New Japan Pro Wrestling, WCW New Japan Super Show. Will you stay until I get back? I asked her. We can talk about this then. She was quiet but resolute. I know what I want from life, and this isn't it, she said. Jan went her way, and I went mine. I didn't want her to go, not even a little bit. But I couldn't help but hear my father's voice saying, "Son, you're not the marrying kind." On arrival in Japan, we were split into groups and assigned a host who would look after us during our trip. Ours had a partly missing digit, which I would grow to learn meant he was a made man, a representative of the Yakuza. My group was Ric Flair, Rick and Scott Steiner, Tony Schiavone, and myself. On the night before the big show, we were taken to a great place for the best steaks I have ever tasted. From there, we were taken to the bathhouse to get a massage. Some of the women that worked there were second or third generation and had a very strict set of rules. For instance, they would not tend to anyone with tattoos. which would have let the Steiners out. Our host, however, had a friendly chat with the owner of the establishment, and the rule was relaxed for the evening. When we left the baths, we went to a nightclub where Jim Hurd, our boss, who chewed me out for damaging the company's reputation, got up on stage and drunkenly sang Chuck Berry tunes. At this point, I just wanted to go to the hotel. I was in this haze of drink, noise, women, decadence, and debauchery, and it didn't set well with me. I didn't know if I was uncomfortable because this wasn't who I was, or because it was who I was now. Just as the parade of ladies was being led into the bar, I found our host and asked him to arrange a ride for me back to the hotel. I was just looking for a cab, but he arranged a bodyguard and a driver. Outside the place, my car pulled up, a Cornish Rolls-Royce convertible, and I was driven around the city by my driver with a bodyguard right out of The Sopranos sitting snugly against me in the back. They made sure they put the top down, even though I was freezing my ass off. I smiled at both men all the way back to my hotel, through chattering teeth. The lights, the buildings, the food, and the drink. The ladies, the money, the travel, the car. It was never more apparent to me just how far away from the farm that I was. Thank God I was not involved in any of the political nightmare finishes the next day. New Japan Pro Wrestling's local star, Tatsumi Fujinami, was going to win the NWA title from Flair in the packed Tokyo Dome. Tony Schiavone and I did some wraparounds from the upper deck with the camera shooting us where the backdrop was the fans and the ring. From those seats, the ring looked like a little dot way down in the middle of the building. It was an amazing scene. We could relax and soak it in because we didn't have to voice over the show until we got back to the States. As I watched the main event, I couldn't understand the political issues that we had on our end about Flair losing to Fujinami. New Japan wanted to get in bed with WCW, and they wanted to work with Ted Turner as a group. I couldn't understand how it would hurt our champion or our title to lose to somebody else's finish, especially when the plan all along was for Flair to get it back at a pay-per-view the following month. In the middle of all the political nonsense, the finish of the match ended up being confusing and overly complicated. Flair lost, so the Japanese audience believed the NWA heavyweight title went to their local hero. But the U.S. audience was told that Fujinami was already disqualified for throwing Flair over the top rope before the pinfall, so the belt didn't change hands. In the U.S., Flair kept the belt, but in Japan, he didn't keep the belt. It was just a train wreck. WCW should have trusted Schiavone and me to protect Flair in losing. We could have told the great story of Flair's travel, the matches he had before he left the States, the jet lag, and Fujinami having home field advantage. We would have sold it like Fujinami barely caught Rick with a 1-2-3. That could have gone either way. We could have built to a huge rematch for the following month. The long-term relationship of New Japan and WCW was adversely affected by the politics of the day involving the NWA title, and Flair was talking about leaving. Chapter 38, Flair Leaves, 1991. Flair finally left. The primary issue was that Rick and Dusty had a nice professional rivalry that they generally kept subdued and under control. But the wild card in that whole equation was Hurd. Hurd had definite feelings about Rick. Hurd wanted changes and wanted younger and new stars developed, and we kept feeding the viewer the same show. The menu never changed. And Hurd, for the sake of change, wanted change. To change for the sake of change isn't good business as a rule. So if you want to change, what's our plan? Well, change into what? That's going to make us better. Why? Hurd wanted to change Rick's persona, and Rick was offended by the fact that he wanted him to change. I totally saw Rick's dilemma. It was like asking Sandy Koufax to start throwing right-handed, and he's the greatest left-hander of all time in the eyes of many. That's how Rick looked at his game. I'm Ric Flair. Why do I need to change? Hurd didn't have the same feel for the business. He looked at Ric Flair like he was a long-time incumbent, and it was time for him to pass the torch. There was a very distinct, stark difference in philosophy and opinion between the two men. Their lack of communication with each other allowed the problem to manifest itself into an unsolvable issue, where eventually there was no solution left on the table. And their tensions were present in the company every day. The people in the office got it from Hurd, and the people on the roster got it from Flair. In the end, people got tired of it. It almost alienated Rick from a lot of people that worked there because they had to live with Hurd. Rick was in Charlotte at his mansion working with his lawyers while a lot of us were sequestered on Hurd's floor at the office, so it just got to be unbearable. Solve the problem for God's sakes. Fix your issues. Come to some sort of middle ground. Can you compromise? Is there nothing whatsoever that can be done to eliminate this problem? Get a mediator. Do something instead of just continuing to wear it out with rhetoric. Ric Flair is no longer with this company, Hurd said to me. He's gone? I asked. Even though I knew of all the troubles between both men, I was sad the great Ric Flair had finally been broken and forced out. He's gone. Good riddance, Hurd said. By the way, you ever hear of anyone walking with a title? Why, I asked. No reason. Rick left all right, and he took the heavyweight title with him, as in the actual belt itself. Rick had laid a $25,000 deposit on the strap, per the instruction of the NWA. Ironically, it was an older rule that was born out of paranoia that a heavyweight champion could walk once he won the title. In Flair's mind, he paid for the belt, and it was his. I don't think Hurd even was aware of the deposit or the legalities of who owned what. It was a sad day when Rick left. It was also unfortunate, and we were all going to miss him, because he was one of those social guys that loved to have fun and was always the life of the party. He was the company social ambassador and a large part of the face of WCW. And with Rick gone, a large part of the NWA legacy, and had now gone to work for the competition. It just didn't feel right. Chapter 39, Changing of the Guard, 1992. Not surprisingly, Hurd was the next to go. It's just not worth it, he said as he packed up his desk. This place has taken years off my life. I'm going home. I knew the constant internal battles were tearing him up, that he was reaching the point of having to step away. He was also butting heads with Dusty as Booker, and getting frustrated with WCW in general. Hurd was facing a near impossible task for someone who had years of wrestling experience, never mind someone like him who had none. After he left, TBS named Kay Allen Fry as WCW's new lead executive. I like Fry, who asked everyone to call him Kip. He He was a smart guy, having earned a law degree at Duke University, a big basketball fan, and was a genuinely nice man who immediately tried to foster a positive work environment. Unfortunately, he lacked the one thing he needed most in his new role. He had virtually no product knowledge and was easily manipulated. Kip had never been a fan. I don't mean that he hated the business, as so many of the holier-than-thou Turner executives did. Wrestling simply had never registered with him. And for a guy who was so bright, he probably thought nothing of having to manage a crew of wrestlers, beyond the fact that he got to be a department head, which would, in turn, be a stepping stone to something more significant within Turner Broadcasting. Kip's other major problem went hand in hand with not being familiar with wrestling, managing the wrestlers. He was too trusting, not understanding that when you had a roster of wrestling talents in that era, it was going to have its fair share of con men. A lot of the guys had the instinct to spot a weakness and the willingness to pounce on it if they thought they could get something out of it. Some of the guys got contracts or perks that would never have flown with someone with more savvy on how the business operates. Fry was one of the first in wrestling to offer guaranteed contracts, which would prove to be a disservice to the company and even to the wrestlers themselves. Paying wrestlers based on the strength of business gave the wrestlers the thing all athletes needed most, the motivation to keep getting better. WCW's guaranteed contracts paid as much for an empty arena as for a sellout. I thought it was a concept that wouldn't work that successfully. However, he did create an incentive that was new and innovative. He gave bonuses for the guys who delivered the best performances at the pay-per-views and clashes. This helped level off some of the comfortable matches that guaranteed contracts helped usher in. Kip also scored something of a get when he brought in Jesse the Body Ventura to be color commentator on pay-per-views. Although he wasn't the first commentator to advocate for wrestling's villains, Watts had Mid-South villains filling in as early as 1980, and Roddy Piper was doing the same a year later on TBS for Georgia Championship Wrestling, Jesse was the one who really popularized the role. I left Oklahoma with a plan of never living with regret. But the way I handled my working relationship with Jesse was something I regretted and wasn't proud of. Fry signed Jesse to an extraordinary salary for which Jesse would only have to work a small amount of dates. He was only fresh in the door and was earning a huge amount of money, more than I was, even though I was doing all the pay-per-views and 52 weeks of TV shows a year. The disparity made me furious. And as a result, I was standoffish with Jesse right from the start. I don't know why I blamed Jesse for getting the big money. I should have blamed myself. I didn't have the right negotiation plan in place. I should have had a plan for how to talk to Fry about how much money Ventura was earning versus what I was earning for the amount of work I was doing. Ultimately, it was wrestlers taking advantage of Kip, which led to his exit. Fry was always doing his best to appease everyone. But in our business, that just means the guys are going to walk all over you. In May 1992, after only a short time with the company, Kip told a handful of folks individually that he was leaving. I was still working in the office all the time, in addition to broadcasting, so I was one of those he personally told. "What would you think of me going for the job?" I asked Jan. Ever since we'd split up, I would call her off and on. We became better friends over the phone than we seemingly did when we lived together. "The department head?" she asked. "Yeah, Fry says he's leaving, and I think I have the experience now to make something good for the company." "I think you should do it," she said. I was a little embarrassed even bringing it up. Wrestling and my obsession for it was one of the reasons that Jan and I had split. "You think I could do it?" I asked. "Jim, I've never met anyone who loves their profession as much as you love yours," she replied. "Why not you?" She was right. Why not me indeed? You miss me yet, I asked? Yes. Want to try again? No. Can I ask you again sometime? Yes. I loved her, and I missed her, and I could hear she missed me too. I walked into the CNN building with my plan laid out and my pitch in mind. A lot of people didn't even know Kip was going to leave, so I felt that I might have a step ahead of whoever else was considering throwing their hat in the ring. I really felt that learning all those different roles under Bill Watts in my early years made me as good a candidate as anyone to be the next head of WCW. I had many years of experience in virtually every area of the business, from the communication, handling public relations, writing publicity stories and radio ads, to working with building managers, recruiting talent, negotiating with talent, booking live events, doing payoffs, booking pay-per-view cards, and writing and formatting television shows. I did all those things. Even within the unique world of wrestling, my education was novel. I hadn't heard of too many people in the business who had experience in all those different departments. Not a lot of people knew Kip was leaving, but none of us seemed to know that his replacement was already in place. Cowboy Bill Watts. Since Bill sold the UWF in 1987, we had tried to stay in touch with each other, but with him out of the business for 5 years, that dwindled to where we stayed in contact about as much as anybody in the wrestling business stays in touch. Not much. I found the wrestling business funny that way, as far as relationships go. I still remember my first road trip with Danny and Akbar when they told me that even after a long career, once I got out of the wrestling business, I would be lucky to be able to count my good friends in the wrestling business on one hand. I thought they were just crabby bastards. Lo and behold, now that I was almost 20 years in the business, I was the crabby bastard saying that to young wrestlers. When people in wrestling separate, usually geographically, they rarely stay in that close a touch because everyone is focused on the new job, the new roster. Bill and I would talk sporadically, maybe 3 or 4 times a year on the phone, but my relationship with him was different than most because he was a genuine mentor to me and taught me principles of the wrestling business that I had used for my whole career. And he was now sitting in the seat in WCW. Jimbo, he shouted when he saw me in the doorway. Bill, come in. He could see I was a little bewildered. I wanted to call you and tell you, he said, but they made me give my word that I wouldn't tell anybody. So I kept my word. You know how that goes. I nodded because that was always true of Bill. When he told you he was going to do something, then he was going to do it. Take a seat, he said, and tell me about this place. I gave him the lay of the land as best I could, about job descriptions, telling him who people were, etc. He asked a lot of questions about everything under the sun, the booking, when the deadlines were for ads and promotional stuff, a lot of the fundamental things. I don't care what they think here in these offices, he said. I'm going to do it my way, no matter the cost. And I knew with those words that Bill's time in WCW would not be long. He had an old-school wrestling mentality in the new-school corporate world, and I had already witnessed how that worked for Ole. They want me to cut costs around here. Big cuts. Where are you going to start, I asked. The system of Cowboy's new department and how TBS structured it was built for failure. The upper management just didn't seem to care who had answers or if there were answers. They were just thinking about how much money WCW was losing. And when some suit in the North Tower decided the guy on top of WCW had lost just about enough, TBS would just replace that guy with another guy. Watts was the new other guy. I also had my own personal headaches when various boys in the locker room began saying things like, Why didn't you say something about Bill coming in? I can't believe you didn't tell me. I said I didn't know. Cause I didn't know. The reply was some variation of, "Oh, come on, you're Watts boy." They couldn't believe it, but I had no idea. Now, all of a sudden, I was looked at suspiciously. On one hand, they wouldn't believe me when I said I didn't know. And on the other hand, I was now seen as Watts' lieutenant who was double-dealing or hiding things from the boys. Everyone knew that there was a new sheriff in town, and things were going to change. How things were going to change, nobody could guess. But there was definitely change in the air. And they wanted me to tell them exactly what those changes were, even though I had no clue. Everybody could tell that TVS hired the wrong guy with Jim Hurd. Hurd was truly a decent man who had some ill-advised ideas. Hunchbacks, ding-dongs, stuff like that. He wanted the great Ric Flair to become a gladiator, cutting his hair, wearing an earring. Whatever WWF was doing that Hurd saw that he thought he might be able to copy, then that's what we did, or what he wanted to do. Watts, on the other hand, had plenty of experience and product knowledge. But his first task, set by the company, wasn't anything to do with the wrestling end of things. His marching orders were to reduce the budget and the losses immensely, and to do it yesterday. This made Cowboy very challenging to work for. Bill was so accustomed to calling the shots and not being second-guessed that, in his own way, he was as unprepared to deal with the corporate people as the corporate people who came before him had been unprepared to deal with the wrestlers. Watts immediately butted heads with Bill Shaw, one of the TVS executives who sat higher on the corporate food chain than us peasants in WCW. Bob Dew, who had managed the Omni, Atlanta's premier indoor arena and the site for major wrestling shows in that area, ended up being the buffer between the two bills. Dew loved to have a cocktail and play golf. He took things with an attitude of easy come, easy go, which also meant he was usually happy to take the path of least resistance. But he didn't know a damn thing about the pro wrestling business either, though he was a hell of a lot better to deal with than Bill Shaw. Shaw was like an evil Andy of Mayberry from the Andy Griffith Show. He managed a number of divisions for TVS, and the last thing he seemed to want to do was to lower himself into having to deal with the carnival freaks of WCW. I thought after one of his visits he'd have hand sanitizers installed outside the door of the WCW offices so he could cleanse himself on the way out. Shaw used to tell us how other people at TBS didn't understand why Turner was in the wrestling business at all. But the ratings were very competitive, and it was wrestling programming, which meant it was somewhat cheap to produce and was first-run original programming. Watts was reducing costs, but making waves everywhere he went. He even restructured my contract to give me more work on the office side of things. He got my job description listed on my contract and put in a significant pay bump, which reflected my new responsibilities. Bill clearly wanted me to fill my old Mid-South slot of being his man on the ground, but I could see from 100 miles away that this was a poisoned chalice. I didn't want to tell Cowboy that I just couldn't see how an individualist like him was going to work out long term. I saw him more as being a great consultant, coming in and working for a week or a month, troubleshooting problems, offering some creative quality control, and getting things restructured when they went off the rails. Bill did some good things. He also did some things that people didn't understand. I love Bill. He was my mentor and family to me. He was the most influential person I had known in my career. But his tenure in WCW really was a detriment to me professionally. It was guilt by association. There was always volatility.